Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Are your hands dried out? Well, mine are, from all of that perpetual hand washing. However, every time I stand at the sink and lather up and scrub for 20 seconds and rinse, I am blown away by this strange juxtaposition. The novel coronavirus is powerful enough to halt most of humanity in its tracks. And at the same time, it's so fragile that simple soap and water can kill it, if it's outside of the body, of course. Now, that is one of the great ironies of modern-day infection control. Even in the age of polymerase chain reaction-based testing and lightning-fast drug development and tech-assisted contact tracing, one of the most important tools in our disease-fighting arsenal is also one of the most rudimentary. Simply washing your hands. In fact, in the early days of an outbreak, it may be the only effective tool we have. And here's another thing that kind of blows my mind. Soap itself might be more than 4,000 years old, but we've only been washing our hands for health reasons for a mere 150 years. So this hour on Point, we'll explore the science and the short, surprising history of hand washing. And we're going to start today with that science. And Miriam Warman joins us from Teaneck, New Jersey. She's a professor of biology at William Patterson University, where she also directs a research laboratory in microbiology. Professor Warman is also the author of The Handbook, Surviving in a Germ-Filled World. Miriam Warman, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So I wonder if we might just start by zooming down to the molecular level, okay? And what is soap made out of that makes it such an important tool in our disease-fighting toolkit?
Well, the chemicals in soap are able to interact with cell membranes, and they are able to disaggregate or separate apart the membrane and destroy cells such as bacteria, but also the outer coating of a virus. Mm. Well, so this type of chemical reaction is very effective.
Okay, so I want to really, really in detail zoom down to why that happens, okay? Because if I understand correctly, soap molecules, like an individual molecule of soap has a kind of hybrid structure, right? Like one end of the soap molecule is water-loving and the other end is not. Is that right?
Yes, it depends on the types of soaps, okay, and also detergents that we use to cleanse other things. But soap is hydrophobic, and as are cell membranes and also the coverings around viruses. And so that type of hydrophobic interaction can disrupt the structure.
Okay.
But the other part of the process of cleansing hands is that various things can stick on our hands. And soap helps to break the bonds between what has attached to our skin, and it helps to get rid of it, and then we just rinse it down the drain.
I see.
So that's another really important part of the process of why soap and water are the most effective way to cleanse the hands.
So
not everything has to get killed. Not all the microbes have to get killed. As long as they are removed from the surface of the skin, then we rinse them away. Very effective.
I see. So just to underscore what you said, there's a physical component to this, that soap, as you said, because it breaks the bonds, it literally washes those it can wash those pathogens physically off of our hands.
But absolutely.
But back to the chemical component of why soap is an effective agent against some pathogens. I just want to be sure that I heard you correctly a little earlier, that let's just take the case of the novel coronavirus. Is it that the external membrane is made up of some oils or fats, and that the soap molecules basically do they disrupt that internal that external membrane, and then therefore break apart the virus?
To a certain extent, that's an important part of the process. But really, I would emphasize that the most important part of cleansing is to take the dirt, including the microbes, the microorganisms, off of your skin, and then it's rinsed down the drain. And that is why it's so effective. Even if it's not that antimicrobial, the fact that we can get it off of our hands, that's the most important part of the process.
Okay, so trapping those dirt particles in micelles of soap membranes and washing them down the sink. Now, you mentioned antimicrobial. I think a lot of people might presume that antimicrobial soap, first of all, what's in it that makes it antimicrobial?
There are a whole group of different types of chemicals that were identified in the past 50 years or so that on direct contact with bacteria, for instance, have a very effective in killing the bacteria. And so for a period of time, those types of chemicals were added to the soaps in the hope that it would improve the effectiveness of killing germs. And indeed, these chemicals really do kill germs. But as I said, they're not necessary, because the whole idea here is to get the microbes off of your skin and then to flush them down the sink to rinse them off. So these antibacterial chemicals that were added, turns out some of them are actually quite dangerous in different ways, and they pose a risk. And so it was decided that these are not adding anything to the effectiveness. In fact, we do want to avoid the risk of being exposed to some of these chemicals.
Right. So this is so important, because I was telling my the On Point staff this morning that about a month ago I had went to the pharmacy to buy more soap for our bathrooms at home. And the section of the soap aisle that had the antimicrobial soaps was completely empty. I mean, people had panic shopped for, you know, Orange Dial or whatever. And then there were some like regular soaps left. But what you are saying, and maybe we can't say it loud enough, is that for home use, soap is soap is soap is soap, right? And you just, like, you don't need the antimicrobial stuff.
That's right. The FDA has been testing these types of chemicals, including one called triclosan, for decades, and they hadn't ever been able to declare that they are generally recognized as safe or effective. And in fact, the FDA has never found evidence of any benefit of washing with triclosan-containing soaps compared to just regular old traditional soaps. So the bottom line is that washing with soap and water is the tried and true and very effective approach to hygiene. And these types of antimicrobial chemicals don't really add anything to the effectiveness. They're not needed or desired in the home environment.
Yeah. And what about hand sanitizer as well? How effective is it? And should people, if they want to buy some, look for particular types of hand sanitizer?
Alcohol-based hand sanitizer is very effective. It does kill most germs. And the thing that you need to look for in hand sanitizer is the alcohol content. So there are different kinds of alcohols. There's ethanol, which is ethyl alcohol, and there's isopropanol. Both are effective, but they need to be present in at least 60% concentration in the product. 60 to 70%. 70% is what many of them typically are, but you don't want to drop below 60% final concentration of alcohol in the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. And when you have that, then it's very effective. Hand washing is still the best choice, but if you can't get to a sink and water and soap, then the alcohol-based hand sanitizers are very effective.
Yeah. Well, so Miriam, let me ask you, I said earlier that when I introduced the show that in the early stages of an epidemic, or at least one like COVID-19, the hand washing might be one of the most effective tools we have. I'm hoping I didn't overstate that.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's one of the things that is very empowering, because when something like this is happening in the community and in society, you can feel very powerless. But this is something you can literally take into your own hands and do to reduce your risk. And even when I wrote the book on hand washing, I was thinking about these issues, not in the context of a giant pandemic, but in the context of everyday health. that we are exposed to germs, even under, you know, normal circumstances, and those germs can introduce a risk. You know, we can catch the flu, we can catch colds, we can catch all sorts of things. But nowadays, it has become critical and even life-saving. So what could be more empowering than being able to wash your hands with soap and water, a very simple act, and reduce your risk of a life-threatening illness? And so it's become quite a topic of conversation now, and I think people are listening, which is great.
Well, maybe you're a scientist too, so perhaps because you look at this issue through a very critical science, important science lens here, I'm just going to say, do you share my wonder here that something as simple and low tech as even basic soap and water can kill this or you know, get rid of hands of this virus, and at the same time this virus is causing so much havoc worldwide? I mean, the juxtaposition of that, I'm not quite sure I can wrap my head around it. It seems amazing to me.
It is. It could be surprising. I've been thinking about this issue for a long time. And again, it is such a very simple thing that we can do. But you have to understand that not everybody was on that page. And many people didn't subscribe to the hand washing protocols that we're talking about now. And so the fact that diseases spread rampantly, that's not surprising. Because in a lot of research, we have found over the years that people say they wash their hands after using the bathroom, for instance, but many people didn't. And now I think it might be going in the right direction where people are taking it seriously. In our own research, you know, through William Patterson University, I have even collaborated with a public health professor. And we've done research to look at glove usage. And that's another big topic that is really compelling. Gloves appear to be protective. They're something that they can keep us safe, right? Reduce our risk. But glove usage is not necessarily done properly, and it can actually increase the risk of spreading germs.
Right.
So these are some of the things that we have to think about and educate people about. And now I think people are finally listening to the message.
No time like the present to pay attention to this. We are talking this hour about the science and the short but surprising history of hand washing. So much more to discuss when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Wash your hands, everybody, and everybody, wash your hands. My people uptown, wash your hands. My people downtown, wash your hands. People from the East Coast, wash your hands.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. That was Dougie Fresh rapping part of the 20 Seconds or More song. The video is a collaboration through Dougie Fresh's Hip Hop Public Health, an organization seeking to promote health equity among young Americans through media. Now, this hour, we are talking about the short and surprising history of washing your hands and why it is such a powerful and important tool in disease prevention in the modern world. I've been speaking with Miriam Warman. She's professor of biology at William Patterson University and also author of The Handbook, Surviving in a Germ-Filled World. And Miriam, I'm wondering if you might be willing to listen along with us a little bit as we dive into the deep history of hand washing. And joining us to help walk us through that is Peter Ward. He's a professor emeritus of history at British Columbia University and author of The Clean Body, A Modern History. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org, of both books, by the way, at onpointradio.org. Professor Ward, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, and my hands are scrubbed clean, let me tell you.
Well, I want you to know mine are, too.
So, first of all, I just want to be sure that I want to fact check myself here, because honestly, it just seems a little hard to believe. Soap. Humankind has had some form of soap. Is this correct since, what, perhaps even as early as 2800 BC, so more than 4,000 years?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay.
But they haven't always used soap as we use it. So I think it often had medical uses or cosmetic uses rather than hygienic uses.
I see. So the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Romans, for the Gauls even. I was reading about how the Romans would write in their scrolls about Gallic use of soap, maybe for textiles even. So when is it that we first began to see soap or hand washing in the context of health, then?
Well, it's as you mentioned at the outset, it's a surprisingly recent development, actually. And it's really related to the long, long, complicated history of human hygiene. It's a story that in the Western world goes back, and well known, in fact, back to the Roman times. But it really picks up in the period from about the beginning of the 17th century onward. And there's been, since that period of time, a huge transformation of body care and body treatment that sort of began in the upper reaches of a number of Western communities and gradually diffused and percolated downwards to our own dear times when we are now obsessed with our cleanliness. At least in some respects, it seems that we exempt our hands to some extent, but the rest of us, we really pay a lot of attention to. So.
Yeah. Well, just if I may, because we just mentioned the Romans a couple times, people might be thinking, well, the Romans had baths. Yes, they did. But they also, one of my favorite things about ancient Rome, when it came to actually cleaning the body of dirt, they would, what, coat themselves in olive oil and use strigils to scrape the olive oil off?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, for them, soap was a cosmetic. They bathe and bathe often, as far as we know. They're magnificent public baths. We still see bits and pieces of in Rome when we're there today. But they were recreational places. They weren't places for personal hygiene, particularly. So.
Okay. And so then, what changes, or why do you point this to the 17th century?
This is a longer story than you and I've got time for in this segment. But there was an ebb and flow of interest in bathing from Roman times until the beginning of the 17th century. The figure I hung this on is a very famous king, Louis XIV, the Sun King, King of France for 72 years. He had two baths in his life. He had one when he was 27 and one when he was 29. He took them for medical purposes, and they weren't successful as medical treatments, and he never bathed again. He washed his face every second day in the morning. He washed his hands once a day in perfumed water, and that was it. And he was not in any way exceptional, except that as a king, we know a bit more about his behavior.
Right.
He probably washed a little bit more than most other upper-class people of the time.
And certainly more than all of the lower-class people of the time.
Certainly more than all of the lower classes. The lower classes were principally rural people who lived on the land, lived close to animals, and they certainly didn't concern themselves with washing themselves. They may have got wet if they fell in the water, but that was about it.
Two baths for a king over the course of his lifetime. It does, to the modern mind, it makes you shake your head.
It does.
But also at that time, there was a completely different theory of disease transmission, though. I mean, the idea that, well, pathogens weren't even understood to be a thing, right? I mean, people would thought
course,
that it was
yeah.
it would that disease was carried in miasmic air, but that changed later, right?
It changed, but only slowly, gradually. The miasma theory, miasmatic theory, to be correct, miasmatic theory, was still widely accepted in the early part of the 19th century. By the time that the first indications that hand washing might have some health-related value began to appear.
Okay, and so you write in your book about what one of those early indications was, what 1841 and Oliver Wendell Holmes publishing a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine.
The New England Journal of Medicine, something that we've all heard of. It was, in fact, in the first volume of the New England Journal of Medicine. Holmes was a doctor and a poet, kind of a polymath, living in Boston. He was struck by the fact that many women developed a fever and died after they gave birth. His concern for childbed fever made him think deeply about why this might be so, and he began to think that there might well be infective material brought to women during the birthing process by their attendants. It was a theory. He threw it out in this article. As far as I'm aware, he didn't follow it up. The New England Journal was a small, remote journal in the larger Western world's journal world of medical communication, and so it really wasn't noticed and pursued further by anybody else, at least immediately, to the best of my knowledge.
Huh.
And it was about almost a decade later in Vienna that a young Hungarian physician by the name of Ignaz Semmelweis noted the same sort of thing in the Viennese General Hospital, the Allgemeines Krankenhaus, which is one of the big old hospitals in European civilization.
Okay, so Professor Ward, let me stop you there, because this is okay. A fascinating part of the story, right? So Semmelweis, did I say his name correctly?
Semmelweis.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
So he noted that there was a very high rate of infection in the maternity wards in the hospital he was working at. But how did he come to the... he had a couple of false starts before he came to the conclusion that it might have been disease being transmitted by doctors who were working on cadaver dissection and then birthing babies thereafter?
Well, the hospital had two maternity clinics. The hospital childbirth at this time was a place where people got their clinical training, and there were the hospital was training midwives, female midwives, and it was training physicians. There was a clinic for each of the trainees, and Semmelweis noticed that the mortality rate for the patients who were attended in the midwife's clinic was much lower than it was in the physician's clinic. And he did a very simple thing. There wasn't any sort of elaborate research that he involved himself in. Basically, he counted annual statistics for several years, and at the end of the year, he was able to demonstrate that fewer maternity patients in the midwife's clinic died, and far fewer as well. And he began to think about why this might be the case. Excuse me. So he thought and began to think about what the clinicians brought to the birthing room. The female clinicians, of course, brought their previous experience as birth attendants and other births. The hospital physicians were active throughout the hospital in various wards, including in the dissecting rooms as well. And of course, he began to think then that they were bringing something on their hands to the birth room that was dangerous to the women in delivery. He then put his ideas forward to his senior colleagues. He was a junior doctor on a short-term contract, and they had other ideas about how diseases were transmitted and what diseases were. He had the misfortune, I suppose, of putting forward his ideas at a point in time when there were a number of different contested views about the causes and circulation of diseases. And as a young and relatively powerless figure in this context, his ideas didn't prevail.
Wow.
So he lost.
Even though he had managed to prove, or at least there was observational evidence that making the changes he recommended really drove down dramatically mortality rates.
Yes, yes, that's true. Well, I think you have to appreciate that he was one among many, that there were other well-established ideas out there. We live in a world today, of course, in this huge pandemic phenomena in which there are competing ideas about the origins of the disease and how it best can be best be treated as well. So his situation was not in some ways dissimilar to ours.
Right.
The people who's in a sort of professional sense, people who are in a relatively less prominent position were less commonly regarded as well.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, and at the same time, as you've noted, Professor Ward, that it was around the same period, or actually a little bit thereafter, that germ theory really kind of germ theory became a more accepted notion about disease transmission, right? We have Joseph Lister, yeah. Louis Pasteur. So it's a matter of timing as well. But getting back to the specifics of hand washing, it kind of still blows my mind that it wasn't until the late 19th century that we made this connection. And yet it still didn't immediately result in large-scale changes in behavior amongst people?
No. We are, as a species, not really open to reason to the extent that we would like to think we are. We don't take to proof easily, as far as I'm concerned. So the idea that people should wash their hands became embedded in medical understanding, and it became deeply embedded in the public health movement in particular. But it took a heroic amount of effort on the part of national and regional and state governments, on the part of international agencies, on the part of public school systems, on the part of youth movements, to train generation after generation of people in Western societies in the need to wash their hands and the means of doing it. It's a project that's still ongoing. Miriam just told us that the research they do continues to indicate that people don't wash their hands nearly as often as they should.
Well, Miriam, let me turn back to you here, because I think another part of this story is that we had, first of all, the work and observations of a couple of key doctors, as Peter has been telling us about. We have the emergence of germ theory. And then, a couple of decades later, maybe mid-20th century, we had business playing a role here, right? Like that major soap manufacturers got into the game of saying washing your hands is actually good for your health. Is that right?
That's right. So that's part of the story, definitely. And I do cover a lot of the history of hand hygiene from thousands of years ago up to today in the handbook. And the things that we have just been discussing are a fascinating part of the story. But as we get to the mid-20th century, we begin to see that hand hygiene, in fact, hygiene in general, and the access to clean water has changed the landscape in terms of human health very dramatically. And the average life expectancy from 100 years ago to today has increased from about the mid-40s up to about 80 or more. Some of that has to do with public health and hygiene, and even the simple act of having access to soap and water. Mm. And the types of procedures that are done in hospitals using aseptic technique now, where now we don't have as high a risk of infection of our patients, going from patient to patient. These are all tremendously important improvements in terms of health, in terms of average life expectancy, in terms of recovery from disease. And these all came about thanks to scientists that were able to show the link between germs and disease, and specific germs and specific disease.
Right.
So it is a long story, and it does cover about 150 years, but they're really tremendously exciting 150 years in terms of science.
Yeah.
I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that the science is critical in terms of helping us to move forward and to be able to deal with this challenge. We have to listen to the scientists. We have to be skeptical and critical thinking and look at the science carefully. But that's the basic, I think, the most important issue here. Is that we need to have a scientific approach.
Well, Peter Ward, this brings me back to what you were saying a couple of minutes ago, that human beings, even in the face of proof, don't easily change their behaviors. We have a question that's come in on Twitter from Natasha, who says her grandfather and his father had strict rules about washing their hands as soon as they entered the house. And she wonders to what extent this may have come from their experience in the 1918 pandemic. Do you think that their like behavior change? We have seen large scale behavior changes due to previous pandemics.
That I can't comment on actually, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think what Miriam has told us is very, very interesting. But I also would want to emphasize the fact that the means that we have to keep clean have really changed dramatically over this period of time. During my lifetime, which has been fairly long now, the proportion of Americans who had a bathroom in their home has gone from about 50% to 100%.
Professor Ward, stand by for just a moment, because I know that there's probably a little bit more to that story, but I'm afraid I have to take a break. So hang on for a moment, Peter Ward and Miriam Warman. We are talking about the short yet surprising history of hand washing. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about rent and renters and eviction and the threat of eviction, especially given the mass unemployment right now that millions of Americans are experiencing due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So if you rent and if you've lost your job, we want to hear your story about, are you concerned if you can make next month's rent? Are you using the rent eviction protection plans that are in place in some states, and what might happen when those eviction protection rules run out? Call us and leave us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Looking to hear from renters and landlords as well. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking about the short and surprising history of hand washing and why it's such an important tool in disease prevention for modern human beings. And I'm joined by Miriam Warman. She's a professor of biology at William Patterson University and author of The Handbook, Surviving in a Germ-Filled World. And Peter Ward joins us as well. He's professor emeritus at British Columbia University and author of The Clean Body, A Modern History. And Peter, before the break, you were telling us about how much things have changed even in your lifetime in terms of people's access to running water, bathrooms, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Well, you can't bathe without privacy, basically. You can't bathe effectively and routinely and quickly. And privacy comes with a room of its own. Well, about half of American homes had a bathroom in the 1940 census. And today, virtually all American homes have a bathroom, as indeed the homes everywhere in the Western world. Some of them have many. So that transformation has been gradual. It's varied from one part of the country to the next and from one social group to the next as well. But it's really been one of the fundamental changes that's been associated with the hygienic revolution and the hand-washing part of all that. In addition to the scientific things that Miriam has been talking about quite rightly and appropriately, there are these additional layers that have to do with access to privacy, access to water, development of effective sewage systems, and so on and so forth. The people who are marginal in our world today are the people who live beyond the edges of these things. I know people in the United States who do live beyond the edges, and there certainly are people in my own country as well, who many of them are First Nations people, the indigenous peoples of North America, who live in more remote areas and who do not have easy access to clean water.
Well,
and I know that's where we're headed.
Indeed. And Professor Ward, it's as if you're hosting the show right now, and I really actually do very much appreciate it. So Peter Ward, Professor Emeritus of History at British Columbia University and author of The Clean Body, A Modern History, thank you so much for joining us today.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
So Miriam, hang on here for just a minute, because as Peter did say, we do need to talk about the fact, the important reality that not everyone has access to the essentials that we're talking about, including running water. And joining us now from Los Angeles is Emma Robbins. She's director of the Navajo Water Project. It's part of Dig Deep, a Los Angeles-based human rights nonprofit organization dedicated to water access in America. Emma, welcome to On Point.
Hi, good day. Thank you for having me, Ate.
So I'm wondering if you might describe to us, amongst the Navajo people in the United States, how much access is there to clean running water on a daily basis for example, people living in Arizona or California, wherever you've been doing your work?
That's a great question, and I think Peter there set it up perfectly. So out of the 173,000 Navajos living on the Navajo Nation, only 30% have access to indoor plumbing and running water. And about 2 million Americans in the United States do not have the same thing, which is a huge injustice. And as we know, obviously talking about that on this show is a huge problem.
But Emma, so let me be sure that I heard you correctly, because it's a important number to get our heads around. Amongst those people living in the Navajo Nation, did you say only 30% have access to running water on a daily basis?
No, so it's 30% do not have access.
Okay, good. I'm glad I asked that, because I heard the wrong thing beforehand. But still, 30% is a huge number. So what do these families do to get access to water?
A lot of families are forced to haul water. And what that means is either they go to watering points across the Navajo Nation. You mentioned states there at the beginning. And the Navajo Nation is a sovereign nation that is occupying three states. So Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico. And to give you an idea of how large that is, if we were a state, we would be the 10th largest. So across the Navajo Nation, there are different watering points, and a lot of times families, as I mentioned, have to go there and haul it. And that's an issue because also in the Navajo Nation, we have some of the highest contamination of uranium. So unfortunately, many of these watering points are not safe, or they're intended for livestock and agricultural use. Another way that families get water is they go to different stores and purchase bottled water, which is extremely expensive.
And they purchase bottled water for drinking, presumably.
For drinking and hand cleaning, you know, which is obviously a ton of bottled water. And Dig Deep is doing something different.
So tell me about that.
So what we're doing is a combination of things. The largest thing that we've done to increase water access is we've developed water trucking routes to rural areas. And what that looks like is they're trucks that have a potable water tank that range anywhere from 2,000 gallons to 3,500 gallons. And so that way, families are able to get safe water. We use safe water sources that are tested regularly. The water truck is swabbed to make sure that there's no bacteria or any other germs that can enter. And we are installing what we call home water systems in rural areas. What those look like are an underground cistern of 1,200 gallons, so a big tank. And there's a series of plumbing, a water pump, a heater, and a sink where safe water comes out.
So, but these have to be built from scratch right now, is what you're saying, is that because the systems aren't there to begin with. I mean, it sounds like a huge undertaking if 30% of people need access to this water.
Yeah, of course, Magnus. So we've installed about 300 home water systems across the three states, which has taken a while because every area is so unique. You know, there's not a copy and paste solution where this technology is used in developing countries. There's not a copy and paste solution on the eastern side of the reservation to the western side. You know, one of the big problems that we come into is that there's a lack of funding to do things like maintain roads, which is obviously a huge issue when you have a huge truck with heavy water going down. And so it's interesting as well, because everybody, obviously, like in cities and everywhere else in the world, live in different types of housing. And so a lot of times we need to tailor what the systems look like in order to make them work properly.
Yeah. So, you know, you've been listening to the portion of the conversation that preceded you, Emma. And I just wonder what you think of the fact that we're talking about this very basic and effective means of preventing disease transmission, about hand washing. And your response to the fact that it requires water to begin with, to do this, to keep people healthy and safe. And yet so many people, Native people in the Navajo Nation they don't even have access to that. It just sets them even further back when it comes to fighting this pandemic.
Yeah. So obviously we know that there are two ways, right? One is staying inside your home. Yeah. Number two is hand washing, as we've mentioned many times. And I've learned a lot in the show, so I was really looking forward to hearing both Miriam and Peter speak about this. But, you know, Miriam said something really important, is that when you are able to wash your hands, it's very empowering, right? You're reducing the risk and you're literally in your hands, you have the ability to save lives. However, when you don't have running water in your homes, you can't do that for 20 seconds. You know, you can use bottled water, but that takes a ton of bottled water to wash your hands. And many families don't have that luxury. And so there's a third element that I always say, you know, well, number one, when you're leaving your house to go get water, you're exposing yourself to the virus potentially. You know, oftentimes you can get to stores and there isn't any bottled water that's left either on the reservation or in border towns. The second thing is, when you're doing that, there's a lot of stress that's involved, right? Mm-hmm. And we see constantly on social media, on the internet, on TV, that those are the things that we can do, staying at home, hand washing. But when you can't do that, it's scary. You know, you start to feel like the other, that you're not able to protect yourselves or your families. And it can be really, really, really impactful on everybody of all ages. And, you know, we're already all experiencing not having money, not having work, you know, having to stay at home, especially in the Navajo Nation. They have a 57-hour curfew on the weekends. And it's hard. And so not having that is a lot more stressful.
Mm. Miriam, did you want to respond to that about what might people do who do not even have access to running water on a daily basis?
Well, Emma's report really puts it into perspective, the fact that this needs to be a top priority for us as, as a nation and as responsible citizens to address that need. But if you don't have access to enough running water to wash your hands for 20 seconds, then do it for a shorter period of time with some soap and rinse it, because even a few seconds is better than not washing at all. And even rinsing your hands, and we have, there's research that I cite in my book, just rinsing your hands reduces the germ load, even if there's no soap. So any type of hand hygiene is better than nothing. Of course, we would want to shoot for the best, which would be the most effective, you know, the 20 seconds and warm water and soap. But hand hygiene is not an all or nothing thing. You can wash your hands, you can wash them better, but hand washing does reduce the risk however you do it. But I think we need to address these pressing, crying needs in that part of the population that Emma is talking about.
Right. And just a technical question here, Miriam, since you mentioned warm water, we did have a question come in from a listener, Russ, who wants to know, what difference does water temperature make during hand washing?
The warm water makes it a little bit more effective, but cool water is also fine. Some people were mistakenly believing that they have to make it so hot that their hands hurt. No, that's not necessary. The warm water allows the soap to lather, and it's also more comfortable and it's more gentle on your hands, which you talked about at the beginning of the show, that your hands are cracked and are hurting, you know, your skin from so much hand washing. One of the things that you need to do is take good care of your hands so that, they don't get overly dry and begin to crack, and then you have new problems, new issues. But any washing is better than nothing. We do have like a gold standard of hand washing, but an intermediate level of hand washing with soap is also effective. And of course, using alcohol-based hand sanitizer appropriately can also lower your risk. And that's the key here. The goal is to lower the risk of spreading germs from the outside into your family and between family members. And you can do that, and you can be empowered to do it with very, very simple measures that that you can adopt.
Right. You know, so Emma, we on this program for a couple of months now have been talking about how this pandemic is raising a mirror up to us about the reality of life for all Americans, regardless of where we live. And clearly that is the case here as well. When we're talking about something as fundamental as running water and Americans and members of the Navajo Nation not having access to that, is there a little silver lining here? I wonder if there has been increased cooperation or meetings, at least, between leaders of the Navajo Nation and the federal government to try and do something concrete and practical about helping people meet people's basic needs?
That's a great question, and something that I've been thinking a lot about and haven't actually really spoken about it yet. You know, as someone who is Navajo and from the Navajo Nation myself, you know, I've grown up seeing how things work and how they don't work and sort of a middle ground on the reservation. And, you know, exactly what you said, there's a silver lining because now many entities, whether they're state, tribal, federal governments or nonprofits like Navajo Water Project and Dig Deep Water, we're all coming together, including with utility companies, and now having this conversation about, you know, the Navajo Nation received this money through the CARES Act, and how are we going to use that long term to improve water infrastructure? And how are we all going to work together to make that happen? Because no matter what sector you work in of the water world or of WASH, we're all working for the same thing, and that's to get people hot and cold running water in their homes and to make sure that they have it forever, that it's not just a Band-Aid solution. So that has been something that's come up and something that I'm really looking forward to continue because, you know, I'm scrolling through my emails this morning and I'm seeing all of these things that indicate that yes, we're going to be able to work together to make this important thing happen.
Well, let's definitely continue that, right? Let's definitely not just hope for it, but continue that work. Emma Robbins, director of the Navajo Water Project, joining us from Los Angeles, California. Emma, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Miriam, we've got about a minute left here. I'm wondering if there's a final note or thought that you want to leave listeners with about the importance of hand washing and why. Thinking earlier about you mentioning that there's still some pretty low rates of hand washing, even for people who enjoy the luxury of having running water every day. We got to increase those rates.
That's true. That's a frustration that I have encountered, a little bit of resistance even. But I think that, again, a silver lining, if you may, to this very dark cloud is that people are listening and they are changing behavior. And I would hope that beyond the pandemic, and yes, I do, I'm confident we will get beyond this pandemic, that this lesson is retained and that we can continue to practice good hygiene, even if we're not faced with a horrible pandemic, but just on a daily basis to keep ourselves and our families healthy, practice good hand hygiene and other types of hygiene that reduce our risk and let us live healthier lives.
Well, Miriam Moorman is professor of biology at William Patterson University and author of The Handbook, Surviving in a Germ-Filled World. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, we have a link to Miriam's book at onpointradio.org and on the website, too, that 1840s paper from Oliver Wendell Holmes about disease transmission that he saw and how hands might be part of that. So that's all at onpointradio.org. This is On Point.